I'm Brother Barley.
And I'm Slouch Sixpack.
Welcome back, Slouch. Let's sip whatever you are sipping on for the great James Gandolfini tonight. Very sad night for all Sopranos fans. Sorry to start off on such a bummer, but the news just came out a couple hours ago. One of the great character actors of our time, and I think, you know, obviously didn't know the man personally, but there's something when an iconic actor who has an iconic character passes, you sort of feel like the character has died too. Well, I guess we all sort of thought Tony Soprano had died anyways. But just one of the all-time great shows. And I think there are shows in my life that have certainly equaled or surpassed The Sopranos, you know, The Wire, Breaking Bad, or Who's the Boss, obviously. But pretty rare you see a character like that. And I think I can probably safely say it's the single greatest television character of my lifetime.
That's probably true, and it changed the medium forever. It made it more cinematic, and really the most interesting stories that are being told in entertainment are happening on television now rather than movies, just because there's not enough time. I mean, you get, you know, 13 or 16 or however many episodes you get with an hour to go, and you can just kind of go into this elaborate detail and these story arcs. And Sopranos was really the first show that did that, and it definitely came at a formative time for us, and it's a bummer.
It really
sucks.
Yeah, great. I mean, I've read the comments online. People are very taken by surprise. People really obviously loved him, loved the show, felt like they got to know him through that show. Obviously he was, I assume, a much better person than how he's portrayed on television. But sad day,
I like to believe that he's exactly the way he was portrayed.
The role he was born to play. All right. Well, I am drinking a quick tangent like that. Drinking a Westbrook Mexican cake. I bought about a dozen. So I had one. It's kind of like it is a much more accessible version of the fantastic Cigar City Hunapu. It's you've seen a few of these days. The kind of imperial chocolate stout that's brewed with peppers, the chili peppers. It gives it that kick, and it's a great concept. Hunapu is sort of the one that really did it for me, that convinced me that this is a very viable style. Sometimes you get a great imperial stout, but it can be a little hot. The alcohol can be a little overwhelming, and there's something about having the chili pepper in there that completely obliterates that alcohol burn. So instead of getting that feeling like someone plunked a shot of vodka Boilermaker into your imperial stout, it just it completely masks that. So it's a great taste combo. It's like the craft brew version of what the Aztecs drank. So this particular one has cocoa nibs, vanilla, cinnamon, and habanero peppers.
It's like the lime juice in the gimlet. There's something about lime that cuts the booze, and I wonder if that sort of spicy pepper has some sort of similar kind of property.
I think it's certainly affecting your tongue probably the same way the alcohol does, and more so it's completely masking it. Delicious beer, but the funny thing was, so I bought a bottle, you know, a week or two ago, and loved it, and thought, I'm gonna get a bunch of these, I'm gonna age them, and gonna, you know, try them out over the years. And then so I bought about 10, and then right on the side of the bottle it very clearly states, do not age, drink immediately. I was like, damn it. So
I love that. Are you kidding?
It's great. No, I'm not complaining about
stuff
it.
Stuff that says don't age it.
Yeah, but I've been drinking.
You're like, fuck it.
I've been drinking one a night.
Could you possibly save one? I really want to try this beer.
I will send you one. There, it's at bulk at Whole Foods. So I will mail you one. I would
bring it to Colorado.
I'll have to check it.
Yeah,
it takes a lot of time. Right. But I'll ship you up. And you, what are you imbibing this evening?
A couple session beers, the Lagunitas Undercover Shutdown Ale, which is out right now. It's excellent, and the Flying Dog Single Hop Citra IPA, which I've been looking forward to for a couple years when I first heard about them making it, and I had talked to the brewer about it during a podcast interview, and it's been draft only for a long time, and it's finally available in Pittsburgh, so I bought a good amount of it, and it is really quite good. Yeah, so
can't go wrong with Citra. I actually almost picked up one of the Westbrook Citra single hop IPAs until I realized it was like 8 months old, so skipped it. But
at some point, Citra will be very passe. I mean, I almost feel like it probably is moving in that direction, but it is a just compared to the other Flying Dog examples of this, they had an Eldorado, and I think they had a Centennial single hop, and this blows those other ones completely out of the water. But at the same time, I'm wondering, it almost seems like this gratuitous waste, because I'm assuming single hop, I'd like to talk to Matt Brophy about this, but I'm assuming single hop, they use Citra for bittering as well. So they probably, I mean, they must use an ass load of Citra hops, which are really hard to find. And a lot of the signature beers from breweries are based on this just because it has a wonderful sort of quality to it. And I'm wondering if they actually just used it for bittering, which really, what's the point in that? I mean, I can definitely see for later in the boil for flavor and aroma, and for the dry hop, you could do that. But I'm wondering if they used it just for alpha acids for this beer.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Citra. It's got a very distinct aroma, but it's possible it's delicate enough or fragile enough that if you use a bigger alpha acid hop, that it could, you know, mess with that Citra. I mean, it doesn't matter how careful you are with the bittering hops, they're going to impart some aroma
sure.
to the beer, and it's possible that it could interfere with that. It's interesting you say that. I think it sort of exploded with the Kern River Citra Dippa, which was this sort of legendary beer and an absolutely incredible beer. And I wonder if that sort of got the ball rolling on Citra. Now it seems like a lot of breweries are doing these single hop Citra beers.
Lots of breweries in England have these flagship once a year beers that are just, the UK is really taking a ton of the lead off of what American brewers are doing.
And
I mean, there's a lot of straight Citra double IPAs and IPAs and going on in the UK right now. And it's just interesting. I mean, that who's ever financially backed this hop into existence, I'm just talking off the cuff right now, but somebody, obviously, it's one of those.
Richard Branson, probably.
You think?
Probably.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Just floating his balloon over the Citra fields of Europe. I think he's replacing the Noble Hops.
The only way you're getting any Citra beer is if you take one of my Virgin space rides. I don't want to go to space, but God, I miss Citra hops so much.
I would go to space to drink a Citra.
That'd be cool, wouldn't it?
I think it'd be worth blogging about. So we've got a bunch of cool stories to talk about. I wanted to very briefly not take up too much time with this because there's really no story here, but something we talked about a little bit this morning. I saw a press release on our favorite beer news website, beerpulse.com, by the great Adam Nason, talking about a new brewery in upstate New York called the Grim Artisanal Ales. And it sounds great. Husband and wife team, they're doing the Gypsy Brewing concept, sort of pioneered by Brian Strumke at Stillwater, this idea of renting out space at other breweries, not having your own equipment, and brewing on other people's equipment, kind of sharing the social space of the craft brew industry, which I think is cool. It seems like a very thoughtful group, and the couple in charge, Joe Grimm and Lauren Carter Grimm, so that is their last name, the Grimm Artisanal Ales. The thing that jumped out to me when I read the press release, the first thing I thought of was that we visited last year the Grimm Brothers Brew House in Loveland, Colorado. And so very similar names, both spelled the same, G-R-I-M-M, again, last name for Grimm Artisanal.
It is similar.
It is quite similar.
Steven, it's like the same word.
One is Grimm
different
Brothers
fonts,
Brew House, very different fonts, and one is Grimm Artisanal. It's different fonts, different marketing packaging, certainly. They're both small breweries in very different parts of the country, so no real overlap as far as distribution. But it's one of those things where we have seen, and we have sort of railed against all the little petty lawsuits between breweries. The first one that kind of got our attention was the whole Gordon Biersch flap, where they were sent a cease and desist letter to Oscar Blues to change the name of their delicious Gordon Imperial Red Ale, which they did. They changed it to Gneit. The beer famously named after a friend of theirs, a brewer and a Vietnam vet who's killed fighting wildfires in Colorado. And we had certainly taken the side of Oscar Blues. And I think a lot of times there are those lawsuits where you read it and think, well, that's kind of ridiculous. We talked in our last podcast about this little kerfuffle between West Sixth Brewery and Magic Hat, that
right.
their logos were very, very similar. And I think you and I were both – there is kind of a gray area there. For me, that was one of those ones I looked at it and thought, well, you know, I always like to back the little guy, but it just seemed like it was too similar. And let me state for the record, there is no lawsuit here. Grimm Brothers hasn't said anything negative. There's nobody suing anybody. I'm just curious, when you see stuff like this, my initial instinct was, you know, a cursory Google search will certainly show you, hey, there's a brewery that has not just, you know, basically the same name as us. And is this something that down the line is going to affect us? And I happened to email the founder. They sent me a very nice email and said,
You sent them a cursory 7-paragraph email.
That is my most that is me and my most cursory, as anyone that listens to these podcasts know. And basically said, real excited for you. Hope you're very successful. Sounds like you've got a great approach. But I'm curious if you knew of Grimm Brothers Brew House or if you'd already talked to them. And Joe Graham wrote back a very nice email saying, you know, hey, we've agonized over this decision, but ultimately this is our last name. And they did some research in the trademark law. And I'm not a trademark lawyer. The Aleheads certainly have a lot of lawyers on our site, but you and I are not lawyers. But he had said it is basically impossible to trademark a surname unless, you know, it's such a brand name that it's basically taken over the brand. And the example he used was Disney. Something like Warner would be another example where it's just the name is so so tied to a business. Sam Adams, another good one. You couldn't start. I think the commander had said this to us when we were emailing about it. You couldn't start the Sam Adams Brewery even if your name was Sam Adams. I guess unless you're the former football player Sam Adams, because that guy's gigantic. He could probably do whatever he wants.
They wouldn't argue with him.
No, Sam Adams can do what he wants. So he sent the response, and I think one of the interesting points, as I said, the commander had written about the Sam Adams thing. He also said something that I thought was very telling is, yes, they could probably do this. Yes, the Grimm Brothers Brew House probably doesn't have a case because they certainly are not large enough to consider themselves a brand name. But he had said, why would you bother doing this? Because ultimately, it could hurt you as much as it hurts the older brewery with the same name because they're just going to kind of confuse one for the other. And as I said, there's no lawsuit. I hope there isn't a lawsuit. This doesn't bother me terribly, but it was one of those things. I read the article and I thought, gee, you know, maybe they should have thought of doing something different. If they knew enough through the research and saw there is a brewery out there with the same name, I'm just saying if I were in their shoes, I probably would have done something differently, but I don't have a cool last name like Grimm. The Cops is just not a good name for a brewery.
Yeah.
So curious. I know you're certainly more on the let's stay collaborative side, let's stay friendly side, and maybe you disagree with me on it. Just curious as to your take. As I say, we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on this, even though I've already wasted 10 minutes on it. But
yeah, well,
it's a podcast.
All we have is time.
Fair enough.
I guess I come down on the side of the case by case, common sense basis. I mean, it seems like that's the way that most things should work in life, and it just rarely does. I can absolutely see a couple of proud homebrewers who have a cool last name wanting to use that, you know, sort of developing the logo and thinking about it for a long time and not being dissuaded by another tiny brewery several hundred miles away that has the Grimm Brothers. And they tend to use a lot of the imagery, like fairy tale stuff, right?
Yeah,
you've been there. I haven't.
Yeah. No, that's they have great logos, great great marketing, but it's all the Grimm Brothers fairy tale type stuff,
which is cool.
Really,
and
cool,
gives
yeah.
you a lot of imagery to draw from and narrative. You could certainly make the case that a couple whose last name it is should have the ability to make and sell beer under their name in a totally different market.
Yeah, and that is their argument. And I wrote back and said, that's great. Thank you for responding. I'm not saying they're in the wrong at all. I wonder if, you know, it's wise in such a crowded and competitive field. According to what he said, there's no real lawsuit here. There's no issue. And
right.
Well, not to belabor the point, but Grimm Brothers hasn't sent a cease and desist letter. Although I will say Joe Grimm did say that he had sent a letter to the Grimm Brothers Brew House and they hadn't responded. Now it may just be they, you know, didn't read the letter, didn't get to it, or that they're weighing their options. I have no idea.
Maybe the evil stepmother took it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I met the guys at Grimm Brothers. They seemed like really nice, decent guys. They made great beer. It was a really cool place. One of the things that I find most frustrating is, let's say they feel like their lawyer sellers, you know, have to kind of force them to sue. I hate this idea that somebody has to be the bad guy,
yeah.
And that you might have to force a brewery that seems like they're really cool guys who just want to make good beer to say, well, eventually we might start distribution in New York, and if all of a sudden this brewery that started a couple years after us and was clearly aware that we existed took this name, as the commander said, they probably can't win the case, but they can certainly make their life hell. And neither one of these breweries can afford this kind of fight. So I'm not knocking this couple at all. I'm really happy for them. I hope they're very successful. I don't want to say anything negative about them. I'm looking forward to trying their beers down the line. I just wanted to, you know, put that out there for anyone who's, you know, getting into the craft brewing field. It may behoove you to, you know, do some research before you name your beers and before you name a brewery and make sure you find something that's kind of unique to yourself and your own. We've seen these, there's like 6 or 7 breweries that have the word mother in their name. There's these huge lawsuits going back and forth, but who can, you know, who gets to use it basically. Mm-hmm. And I just find it frustrating. I wish everybody could just find a, you know, sort of that happy place, that, you know, unique name that's unique to them, and not have to worry about this stuff. But hopefully this won't be an issue at all. Joe Grimm said he'd like to get a response from the Grimm Brothers Brewhouse, and maybe they can do a collaborative, you know, Grimm squared beer of some sort, which would be really neat to watch. And I don't get the impression from either brewery that they have any intention of growing so large that they're starting to battle each other. You know, and for distribution, and maybe that's the common sense answer: is if you know you're not going to be impinging on each other's areas of distribution, then so be it. You can have similar names.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting close to. I don't even know what the number is. I used to keep track of these things.
Yeah, it's pushing
probably
3,
getting close
now.
To 3,000,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, easily. I mean,
that's a,
it's a lot of breweries.
And that's just the brewery names, and they each have umpteen beers. I mean, at a minimum. Probably 15 or 20 beers at the maximum, 200,
oh, yeah,
300, 400 beers that they've made. That, I mean, there's so much overlap, and I think that's a big part of when we first started getting interested in this. I mean, you'd see Avery and Russian River with the collaboration, not litigation, and there could have been litigation on that, but the people sort of rise above it, and they realize that this isn't going to help you. It's not going to help me. There's this brotherhood to it. Now there's so many people, and with varying degrees of experience, varying degrees of what the beer industry means to them, and there's so much overlap. It's hard not to think that you're just going to see a flurry of these kind of things, and it's such a waste of money. I mean, we don't need to give – the very little capital, as you put in your email, which I thought was a good point. I mean, these breweries are operating on such thin margins and have so little capital getting started to try and achieve their dream of a brewery in their neighborhood that makes great beer. Do you really want to put your money towards this kind of shit?
Yeah, that was mostly my point. It's not that they've done anything wrong. It's just is it really worth their while? I mean, I can't remember who came up with it first, but there's a beer on the shelves that was Something's Big Dippa. And, you know, we abbreviate double India Pale Ale as Dippa. And I just thought that was great. Big Dippa, very, you know, very somewhat clever name, you know, seemed very obvious, but nobody had used it yet. Then all of a sudden, a month later, there were like 6 of them on the shelves from 6 different breweries. And you realize that you're right. I mean, there's got to be, you know, granted, a lot of the beers are draft-only stuff, and the names don't matter as much for those, but there's, you know, thousands upon thousands of commercially made beer on the shelves now, and a lot of them share very similar names. I mean, how many just flat-out IPAs are there with no real name to them? So there's going to be some of this sort of, you know, back and forth, and people, you're going to see some of the more litigious breweries trying to, you know, make more outrageous claims about what they own and what names they can use. I remember, you know, when Anheuser-Busch bought Goose Island, they started trademarking all area codes, all the telephone area codes, because they wanted to do the urban wheat 312 concept, the Goose Island 312 concept elsewhere. There's going to be some ridiculous stuff like that. I think a lot of these are sort of silly, but again, sometimes I look at things like that West 6 Magic Hat or this Grimm thing and think they could have avoided this. In this case, there's nothing to avoid. I'm talking about it as if there's a lot.
Luckily, from a blogger's perspective, there's all these sort of grim headlines we can use, like a grim event or
true.
Yeah,
it's definitely a boon for us.
Yeah,
but anyways, they were super nice. Both Grimm Brothers Brewhouse, we visited there last year. I'm hoping we get a chance to during our Colorado trip this summer. and really nice guys and great beer. And this, again, I haven't tried the Grim Artisanal Ales beers yet, but the couple seems great. They responded immediately to me, sent a very thoughtful email. I hope they're very successful. I thought it was worth talking about. Just another interesting interesting hazard of the crowded craft beer world these days.
It's dangerous.
It is. A dangerous place.
Avoid it. For the faint of heart.
Avoid it at all costs. So the first story, the second story, the first one we just kind of threw in there because we happened to be talking about this morning. The first real story we're planning on talking about, I'll let you introduce regarding Laurelwood Brewery in Oregon.
Okay. Well, I was actually going to have you do it since you've been to Oregon, and I don't really know much about Laurelwood. The basic gist of this story is that they announced that they're going into a partnership deal with Craft Brew Alliance, which is the parent company of such previous sort of craft brewing entities like Widmer and Kona and Red Hook. And in the past, we've certainly argued the merits of whether Widmer and Kona, Red Hook, still qualify as craft breweries because, of course, Craft Brew Alliance is owned in part by AB InBev. And it looks like they're going to be contracting to up the production of a couple of their different beers, their Free Range Red and the Workhorse IPA, to try and increase distribution. They're still going to continue business as usual in the brew pubs and whatnot, but this comes on the heels of 10th and Blake, which is based in Chicago. Their production facility, I believe it's in Milwaukee, is doing some sort of 10,000 square foot increase, and we're going to see certainly a ramping up of acquisitions. There's going to be a lot more of beer that is brewed under a certain label type, and the line between craft, which as it is you know, defined just by the Brewers Alliance, is foggy. It's getting very, very foggy at this point. Do you even care anymore? Does this anger you? Should we care? Should we not drink Laurelwood if you're out in Portland?
Right.
I'm not sure what to think anymore.
I mean, you're probably asking the worst possible person this question, because I mean,
that's why I'm asking you.
So
you are the worst possible
that
person.
That's true. In all ways. So do I care? Yeah, I care immensely. And have written about this at length on aleheads.com. So Craft Brew Alliance, as you said, is owned. It's about a third. 33% of it owned by Anheuser-Busch InBev. So they technically do not qualify as craft beer according to the Brewers Association, which granted their rubrics are a little fuzzy at best, but right. they say if it's, I think it has to be 20% or under. Is that right? Or 25?
I think
it's 20. Well, one or the other. Doesn't matter.
This is my question. Does this matter?
Well, so does the number matter? Not so much, but, I think what you've seen, so again, Anheuser-Busch InBev owns 33%, but they're clearly running the show here. I mean, you saw what happened with Red Hook. Red Hook just sort of exploded their production. They're brewed in Woodinville, Washington, and in Portsmouth, New Hampshire as well. And their beer, I can state, you know, people always question, oh, when Anheuser-Busch takes over a brewery, does the beer really get worse? People, you know, bitched about Hua Garden, what Anheuser-Busch did to them, or Stella.
Right.
I can attest that Red Hook used to be a much better beer before Anheuser-Busch came. I mean, this is a beer we drank with some frequency in New England growing up, and certainly in college. And it got significantly worse. And they started focusing. This is what they do. They started focusing on what they thought were going to be the big selling brands and kind of pushing away the stuff that might have been a little more interesting. They did it with Goose Island, you know, just sort of ramping up the production of the Honkers. And they seem to be doing the same here with Laurelwood. Now, you know, I've been to Oregon a few times. Laurelwood is not one of those breweries you seek out. It's more of a smaller local brew pub type beer, like McTarnahan's. It's not that it's bad beer. It's just it's not one of the sort of darlings of the craft beer world in the Portland area. And it's mostly, you know, a group of brew pubs. I think they have at least a couple in Portland. I know there's one at the airport. I remember walking by it last time we were there, and I think there's one up in Washington State as well. So again, nothing to write home about.
It's a small increase. It looks like they're going to up distribution through contract of their the red, which, interesting, the free-range red, it turns out, one of the things it has going for it is it uses all organic ingredients and it's certified organic, and that's going to go away based on this contract acquisition. It looks like they're going to do at least next year about 12,000 extra barrels between the red and the IPA.
Which is nothing.
A small deal, but I think that this is the sort of insidious creep
that you're going to see. Anheuser-Busch, but you know that's a 300% increase in what they were in what they were brewing, and I think you know it sounds like a minor thing, this idea of organic beer, but that's kind of a big deal. I mean that was sort of Laurelwood's you know their little blue ribbon was the fact that they made this great organic beer, and now it won't be. So they're kind of losing what made them a little bit special. Otherwise, they make sort of a standard IPA and a standard red, and that's what Anheuser-Busch obviously saw as the things that they could kind of ramp up. I mean, we've talked about this at length. A lot of people, probably the majority of people, say, if I like the beer, I don't care who's behind it.
People.
And I've sort of argued over and over
Except
again.
Except for our listeners. If you listen to this, don't take it personally.
We love you.
Take a deep look inside your soul.
But I look at Anheuser-Busch, I look at Sab Miller, I look at Molson Coors, and you know the way they operate to me is so antithetical to the brewing to the current craft brewing industry, in that they really are. I wrote this post which got some positive and some negative comments, but this idea that I find it very difficult to support publicly traded breweries, and that even includes, you know, one of the old darlings that I grew up with, Sam Adams. I think when they went public, they sort of started focusing too much on the bottom line and less so on their beer. And we talk a lot of the aleheads that we get burned a lot by Sam Adams these days. You buy a bottle that looks really cool and ends up being sort of a weaker version of a style that you thought you would like. And that's probably the most inflammatory part of that post. It was kind of intentionally done to get people to comment on it. But the truth is these publicly traded companies operate very differently than the private craft breweries. I mean, they have
a legal imperative to return value to shareholders, and that doesn't always mean maintaining an organic sort of lineage with a flagship beer or any of that stuff. I mean, it puts you on a different course, and
You look at what AB's done with Bud and Bud Light. They already were making it basically as cheap as possible, but because people are buying less Budweiser these days and their numbers are dropping, the way that they can make more money is by cutting costs. And to their credit, they've done a great job. They've fired a ton of people.
My favorite way was with the bow tie cans.
Yeah,
they're right. 11 ounces now.
Yeah, they cut some ounces from the beer cans.
Weirder shaped, but it's smaller.
They started using cheaper rice. You used to have these whole grains of rice. Now, granted, rice is probably the cheapest, crappiest ingredient you can already put in beer, and they've even somehow found a way to get worse version of that in there. I mean, everything they do to cut costs. So it's just the way they operate. It's that cost cutting mentality. It's the way they use incredibly misogynistic, sexist marketing to get people to drink their products. Just bashing you over the head with it. It's basically just this giant marketing shell that makes this shitty beer. Now they're they're buying Goose Island, which, you know, by all accounts is still making perfectly fine beer. Laurelwood, they don't own Kona or Red Hook, but they own a big chunk of the company that is the parent company of them. And we have discussed a lot, you know, if the beer is still okay, does it matter? And I say it does, because ultimately you're filling the coffers of Anheuser-Busch, a company that, in my mind, hurts the beer industry. Same with Molson Coors, same with Sab Miller. This has probably been the thesis of our blog and our discussions over the past few years, and a lot of people disagree with it immensely. I have no problem with that. If you think it's just about the taste of the beer, again, more power to you. But we feel very strongly about this. So Laurelwood, hey, I don't get Laurelwood beer; it's not available where I live. But this will just add to my list of breweries that I don't care about. We've got 3,000 breweries I can drink beer from. I don't need to drink beer from a brewery associated with the big three.
And I don't care about Laurelwood at all, obviously. I mean, this is a minor story, and it's gone totally under the radar that they're getting a little bit of investment, and this is probably the way that these investments are going to go.
Sure.
I mean, this is similar to a Terrapin acquisition, where they're not buying the whole – they're not buying the whole brewery. They're not buying the whole brand. They're just investing the stake. They're helping a brewery sort of expand or whatever. the Goose Island thing was sort of the watershed moment, and a lot of beer bloggers and beer writers in Chicago that are deeply attached to that brand. I mean, I don't drink Goose Island. I never did. I never had it in Pennsylvania before. I mean, it's here now.
Yeah,
now
it's in Alabama now.
Now that InBev came through. And, you know, Pete Brown, one of the best beer writers in the world, just put out a 50 international beers you have to try list or something like that. And Goose Island IPA was on there. And, I mean, it's just, I want to write to him. I mean, there's hundreds of better IPAs, but then I was thinking about it. When's the last time I had a Goose Island IPA? Okay. I just sort of refused to drink it. So, but the smartest thing they ever did was, and I didn't, it was probably because of sort of these legal wranglings, was not buy those brew pubs, because the beer scene in Chicago is one of the strongest in the country at this point. There's tons of influential brewers, beer writers, just sort of personalities in that Chicago region. And Chicago, the Goose Island brew pubs are still turning out absolutely amazing beer. Apparently it's not owned by InBev. That's the argument that keeps getting splashed back at me whenever.
Yeah, I mean, and there was just an article this last week that was saying that the Clybourne Ave brew pub is actually in danger of closing, that they're going bankrupt or something, so...
Yeah.
So I assumedly they're not owned by Anheuser-Busch InBev, because I can't imagine Anheuser-Busch letting a brew pub. I feel like they have enough money to pay.
Make some sort of Tony Soprano offer to the landlord. But that has become their Teflon shield, the Bourbon County Stout and the King Henry and sponsoring everything, and all this goodwill has really served as a shield for the distinction with what's going on as they try and make that a brand nationally.
We can mock them at length and pretend like they're these, you know, idiots making terrible decisions with terrible beer, but Anheuser-Busch InBev is a very smartly run company. I mean, they know what they're doing. They know how to use these small brewers as kind of, like you said, shields. You see it. One of the reasons that I argue against them so fervently is you look at things like Blue Moon or Shock Top or Batch 19. It doesn't say on the bottles brewed by Coors, brewed by Anheuser-Busch. They make up these fake shell breweries, the Blue Moon Brewing Company, the Shock Top Brewing Company. They are brewed by Anheuser-Busch, but they pretend that they have this separate company making their beers. And what they're trying to do is trick, you know, people that are just getting into craft beer or starting to switch away from, you know, the crappy macro lagers and think, oh, I'm drinking a craft beer because it's made by this brewery I haven't heard of before. To me, that's just sort of – it's so telling that the companies know that there's a stigma attached to their brand. So they're basically lying to you outright on their products and saying, oh, no, we're not associated with this at all. It's a totally different brewery. And you had talked a little bit about Terrapin. I think the owner – you read the quotes from the owner at Laurelwood. It's the same as what you heard from the people at Terrapin. I think this makes sense. You know, they're basically saying, we still own our company. CBA or Anheuser-Busch, you know, or 10th and Blake, depending on whether you're talking about Terrapin or Laurelwood, is still an independently owned company, but we are now gaining access to the largest brewers in the world, and that allows us to expand very quickly, gives us better access to distribution. You know that the brewers and the brewmasters for Anheuser-Busch and Molson and Molson Coors and Sav Miller are great brewers. I mean, you can't make that kind of shitty beer that consistent for that many years unless you know what you're doing.
Oh, one of the scariest things, I've never tried it, but I've talked to people who have, like, some of the best sour beer, which is a huge untapped market in this country, are being made in experimental batches by the AC Golden in Colorado, yeah, which is a Coors brewery. I mean, they are on this shit, and it, you know,
they're not stupid. They see the writing on the wall, and they know to change their stuff. But I had sort of likened this to this idea of a steroids injection, this kind of almost illegal way of growing, which it's obviously not illegal, but this idea that a large brewery can come in, take a small brewery, and let them basically dominate their other local competition that are really trying to grow organically and, you know, distribute the right way and make and create fans, this fan base. By basically jumping on board this massive company and getting access to these things that other small breweries don't have. You know, it's like the two local bands, you know, fighting for dominance in your local market, and one of them all of a sudden signs to this major record label and just destroys the other. It's to me, I like the breweries that sort of, I call it growing the right way. You know, a lot of people argue, hey, in a capitalist economy, you do it whatever way you can. And I would say in a capitalist economy, the consumer ultimately gets to choose. And my choice is to support those breweries that are growing on their own.
I got to say, I was in a bottle shop today, and the beer that I most wanted to pick up based on sort of my mood, and I've been assaulted by these hugely hot beers and double IPAs that keep coming out. I mean, it's been, like, brutal. The last 2 months, every week there's a new double IPA that's super fresh that hits the stands that I have to – and the beer that I most wanted to pick up was the Saison from Terrapin, the Maggie's Farmhouse Peach. I'm like, that's what I want. But I saw your little face hovering right by the label, and I just got guilty. I'm like, I can't do it.
Glad
now it's a podcast tonight.
Glad I can influence you from afar, hovering over your shoulder. So, you know, hey, more power to Laurelwood. I understand small brewery that they want to grow. This is an easy, you know, way for them to grow fast. I do feel like they've sold their soul a little bit. And hey, I wasn't drinking them before. I'm certainly not going to drink them now. But I'm not wishing them ill. I don't want them to fail. But this isn't the way I like to see breweries grow. I feel like if you do it right and make good beer, in this craft beer world that we currently live in, you can become the next New Belgium or Sierra Nevada without selling yourself to this. And there is an argument, and a legit argument, that a lot of these breweries that aren't owned by or partly owned by these big breweries are still selling out chunks of their company to private investors and those things. And I, you know, that's a gray area. But ultimately, to me, those private investors aren't hurting the beer world the way Anheuser-Busch, Molson Coors, and Sav Miller are. So I do think it's not as black and white as I'm making it out to be. But I've always said, hey, as long as you don't sell to those three companies, I'm cool. I'm cool with it. So anyway, so interesting story, something we tend to talk about a lot. Moving on to brew festivals. So there's this great brew festival that's been going on for a few years now in Washington, D.C., a town I used to live in for quite some time, called Savor. Certainly considered one of the great beer fests in the nation. And this year, I guess it was just last week, they held it for one time only, basically, in New York. And the reason was that the Craft Brewers Conference, one of the other major craft beer events of the year, happened to be in D.C. this year. And they wanted to just sort of, you know, move it to New York City, get Savor somewhere else, try it in a different town. It will be coming back to D.C. Next year, but they just want to try it once in New York.
I think we should go next year.
I'd love to. I'm a huge fan of D.C. I miss it desperately. I lived there for a number of years and thought it was a great town. And definitely becoming a really cool beer town. There weren't a lot of breweries there when I lived there, but you know, that's probably true everywhere. It's only exploded. It's only in a few cities like Portland where there was a major beer scene even 10 years ago. And now all of a sudden,
so when did you move out of D.C.?
2007, I left D.C. Okay. So I don't think Savor was there yet when I left. So they were in New York, and there's an op-ed piece written by writers for DCBeer.com, Jake Berg, who's someone you talk to quite a bit in cyberspace, and Nick Rakowski. And it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek, you know, sort of funny post, but an interesting post, something worth talking about, where they looked at, you know, some of the metrics of what happened with Savor, and basically they think it proves that D.C. is a better beer town than New York City. Their argument was that the tickets for Savor in D.C. sold out in minutes when it was held there, and in New York they never did sell out. I mean, you could buy them on StubHub for a third of the cost of the ticket price, up to, you know, a day or two before the event. And it just wasn't marketed the same. People didn't seem that excited about it. You know, they have said they kind of looked through a lot of stuff in New York that, you know, there are a bunch of beer bars there, but they didn't have the, you know, the same depth and breadth of beer as you might see in other cities. They pointed at the kind of hilarious thing. I don't know if you've seen it at Yankee Stadium, where they have their like craft beer section, a little craft beer bar, and it's all Anheuser-Busch owned products. Yeah. Or, you know, I forget what they call it. But none of it's craft, obviously. And so their argument is that New York is a cocktail town and a wine town, and not a beer town. So, you know, you and I visited New York City a lot, drank a lot of beer there. I certainly have my opinion, but I'd love to hear yours.
I wanted to hear your opinion about D.C. as a beer town versus New York, but it says something about the state of craft beer that when you left there in 2007, and I visited you in D.C., and we were somewhat into beer, not nearly as obsessive as we are now, but, I mean, we went to the Church Key and a couple of the
more important. Brick Skeller was the big one we went to.
Brick Skeller. Yeah, that's the one that was
Trichke
sort of by
Trichke hadn't opened yet when we left.
Well, there you go.
But we've been drinking. Maybe you thought you went there. But I've been.
I went to some place that just had bourbon. I remember that.
That was bourbon. Great bar. Great name.
That hurt.
Excellent bar. DC was when I was there. You know, again, this is, you know, it's interesting. It wasn't that long ago, but there weren't a lot of craft beer towns, even as recently as 2007. I mean, this explosion has really been in the past 3 or 4 years.
Well, New York was no kind of beer town in 2007.
No, not at all. You know, that was the height of the kind of, you know, the cocktail explosion, right? The sort of craft cocktail explosion, and New York City was sort of the epicenter for that. I would not say that New York City is significantly better a beer town than D.C. I think the issue with New York is, and it's kind of brought up in this article, but maybe they're kind of using it to bash New York a little bit, as, you know, all cities like to bash New York a little bit, is that, right, New York's just kind of an everything town. I mean, whatever you want, they've got it there. I've had some wonderful beer evenings in New York. I mean, there's some great bars there. But I will say it's not like you can't call it a true beer focused town, because it just isn't. It's got so much other stuff going on. You know, it's so good at everything.
There are 35 bars scattered across, you know, hundreds of city blocks that are, you could put up against any beer bar in the world. I mean, Pony Bar and Blind Tiger and some of the places that we've been. I mean, they're some of the best beer bars in the world.
Yeah, Garrett Oliver.
Most knowledgeable staff, the best selection.
Yeah. I think one of the things holding it back is that it's an extraordinarily expensive town as far as real estate, so there really aren't any local New York City brewed beer. Now, you've got, you know, Brooklyn Brewery, but they only brew a very small percentage of their beer on site, and that's
right.
You can't knock them for that. I mean, you know, you think how much space you need to open a brewery. There's a reason most large breweries are opened in, like, the shitty industrial parts of town near the train tracks or, like, the highway, because you need space and you need quick distribution, and New York doesn't really have that kind of space to spare.
Brooklyn has been certainly working to expand their physical plant in Brooklyn.
I think New York's a great beer town. It just happens to be a great everything else town, too. You know, it doesn't have the reputation of, you know, something like Portland is obviously very unique, but even, like you said, Chicago, I think Boston and Philly are two examples where they take beer really seriously. Where when you think of what's the first thing you're going to drink in Boston, you know, it's going to be a beer. It's just sort of a beer town. In New York, maybe you have a beer, maybe you have a martini, maybe you have a glass of bourbon. You know, whatever you want, they're going to have it available. And the city, just by sheer immensity and variety, is not going to focus on beer the way it would elsewhere. And, you know, it's hard to market an event like Savor in New York, where in D.C. it's kind of like the beer thing going on there. In New York, there's probably like 20 little beer things going on at any one time. So I don't necessarily disagree that New York is not a great beer. I mean, I don't think of it as being one of my top beer cities, like a place you would go to for a beer experience. But only in the reason, you know, if you go there, you can have a beer experience or a million other things. If you go to Portland, you're pretty much just having a beer experience.
I'm having a beer experience right now.
Well, I'm just having a beer experience.
What do you even think about comparing these? We've never really sort of delved into that on our particular site. I don't think, maybe we have, but I mean, beer city to beer city, it's almost like everywhere I go, there's something awesome to look into now. I mean, I love going to Tampa. There's little places popping up all the time, little cities in Michigan. I mean, can you really compare like Grand Rapids to New York and say Grand Rapids, Michigan has a better beer scene, or Washington, D.C. has a I understand where the DC beer bloggers are coming from, and there's a little bit of a chip on the shoulder, and you know their signature event was taken away probably for monetary reasons to see if they could make it more successful in a bigger market, and it hasn't worked out, and there's a lot of glee and sort of you know, about 3,000 words where they pound out every point.
Right.
And I can certainly understand the emotion of that, but you know, beer culture to beer culture.
Look,
does it even make any sense to say this is better than this?
I am a Boston native, Boston born and bred, New England guy. You know, bashing New York is in my blood, and even I would say it is sort of silly to say New York's not a good beer town. I think the difference is what we just talked about a few minutes ago. New York doesn't have the same local brewing scene that those other cities do. Now, that's not to say there aren't a lot of New York-based breweries like Six Point, like Brooklyn, but again, most of their beer is brewed.
Well, Six Point's mostly brewed in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's true of most of the New York beers. I mean, there really aren't a lot brewed in the city itself, and again, that's for a real estate thing. But I compare it to L.A. I mean, L.A.'s got a ton of great beer bars and lots of nearby cities that have a lot of great breweries, but I don't think of L.A. itself as being a great beer town. Right. So it's a matter of, you know, I would think of Asheville, North Carolina as being a better beer town than New York because it's more, you know, it's more focused on beer and on brewing, but you can get 1,000 times more variety of beer in New York than you could ever get in Asheville, and probably a lot better beer than you could in Asheville. That's starting to change with so many of the big breweries moving there. But if you want to do like a beer trip or a little, a beer travelogue type trip, you'd rather go to a place like these, you know, even smaller towns like Asheville or Fort Collins, that have maybe a dozen breweries in the town that, you know, so we went to Fort Collins last year, and literally every human being I talked to in the town was only talking about beer. If they weren't in the brewing industry, they were trying to get into the brewing industry, they were beer bloggers, everything. And there's something to be said for being in a little town like that where it's all anybody talks about, and even if they're not really into beer, they know enough about their local stuff to be able to have an interesting conversation about it. Whereas in New York, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on. So it's, you know, yes, you can be in a great beer bar. I mean, you know, even the chain one like Ginger Man is a wonderful selection. And talk to people about it, but ultimately they're focused on other things, more things than just beer. So as someone that is obsessed with craft beer, I would say there are far better beer towns because there are places you can go to where that is basically in the blood of everybody there, and Portland obviously being the sort of ultimate example of that, and New York isn't like that. But to say that, you know, it's that you can't get good beer there, that they don't focus on beer that much, it's only because there's so much other, you know, other stuff going on. And that said, I'm glad Savers going back to D.C. I think of it as being a D.C. event. I think it was sort of silly for them to move it to New York. I get why it didn't do as well there, and they take some glee in that because it basically just justifies their town and that you know, that the Beer Fest is better there. But, yeah, you wonder something like, hey, what if the Great American Beer Festival moved to New York? Would it be as successful there? That's a big brand name that everybody knows.
Right.
You know, would it be as gigantic there as it is in Colorado? So, anyway, I like the article. I'm always up for some New York bashing. It's a city that just assumes it's better than everybody else at everything, and most of the locals would say it's because they are.
I love it because I'm a big Garrett Oliver fan, no matter what. I'm sure you could dredge up a number of things I've said about his opinion pieces over the years, but I love how he gets down and dirty in the comments of this article. We'll post it on the posting for this if you want to go check it out, but he gets into it with the DC beer bloggers who I enjoy reading all their stuff, and I definitely check it out. But I appreciate a brewer who's going to go in, you know, six or seven comments deep defending his territory.
Right.
Perhaps when he argues, he doesn't necessarily – it's like arguing with the commander where you argue with him, but he starts arguing about something that's completely different than what you were talking about.
And everything.
And then he says he won.
Yeah,
he's
right.
Like, you know, he's like, well, but, he takes it in a different direction, but sort of the passion of it.
Right.
You gotta admire that. And that's totally Garrett Oliver.
He's so well-spoken. I mean, he did say in his first comment,
so well,
I've yet to see any place with a better beer culture than New York City. I mean, I will call him on that. That's simply not the case. He can certainly argue that you have access to beer in New York that is equal to or better than.
You can probably get a better variety of beer within a 50-mile radius of New York than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah,
I would probably...
Anywhere else in the world, sure. I mean, you know, there are towns in Belgium that probably make more varieties of beer than anything you could find there.
Well, not since the explosion in American craft brewing. I would imagine that's true based on absolutely nothing.
I think Portland certainly has more access to.
Yeah, that's.
I think San Diego has, you know, has more great breweries. You know, that's.
Michelle and others bring everything in New York.
His argument is that there are lots of great beer bars nearby. And that's true, because wherever you are in New York, there's lots of great everything nearby. But just because you have places serving the beer, I mean, I've like I said, I've had great beer weekends in New York, but generally speaking, if you go to 10 craft beer bars in New York, they're all serving the exact same beer. It's whatever happens to, you know, have come into New York that day. It's just the way distribution works there. Whereas, you know, you can go to much smaller towns and go to a half dozen, you know, beer-focused bars, and they'll have completely different tap lists going on. So I don't argue with Garrett Oliver that New York City is not a great beer town, but I do disagree with his point that it has the best beer culture.
Yeah.
I think it's a great beer town. Beer culture, that's a very different
phrase. But that's not really what he was arguing anyways, if you look at what he was saying.
No,
and that's,
but he did.
That's what it's like arguing with Garrett Oliver or the Commander.
Right, yeah, and he says that. I've yet to see any place with a better beer culture in New York, and then he goes on to say, look at all these bars nearby. And no one's arguing that New York City doesn't have a ton of great beer bars. I just think when you use the phrase beer culture, it's a very specific thing that means people are very, very focused on beer and on craft beer, and I've been to at least a dozen towns where that it's much more important than it is to people in New York City. And again, you can't knock the people in New York. They got other stuff to do. They're busy working till midnight every night and selling their souls and dying young. All right. So the next story, this one's sort of near and dear to you. I'll let you jump into this. But this comes from topfermented.com, which so help me out with this. You certainly talk to these guys more than I do. Is that sort of the blog of Mystery Brewing Company, or was it a blog?
It's a blog written by Eric Lars Myers. It was started before he was able, he did a successful Kickstarter campaign. I think he raised about $35,000 on Kickstarter. At the time, it was the most successful brewery Kickstarter launch before everyone sort of turned on the idea of raising money on Kickstarter.
Thank you, Zach Graff.
Yeah, exactly. I've interviewed him before. I think he's probably the best writer brewer that I know of. I think he communicates his points extremely well. And the thesis of this particular post was basically why, in his business model, he had moved away from the idea of a flagship beer, something that was available all year long, and moved into the availability of seasonals for his brewery. And to take it a step further, he broke it down, I believe, into like four different columns where at any time of year you're going to have a hop-forward beer, a Belgian-inspired beer, a session beer, and then something that's just truly seasonal. So you've got four different beers on tap, which I think they run a seven-barrel brew house. And some of the successes that he's had with that model, which I think is definitely would be seen in their own tap room with the variety and the turnover with the customers that coming into a particular place. Craft beer drinkers enjoy having a big variety. And some of the challenges that maybe in theory it sounded good, but when it comes to the way that beer is sold and distributed and the way that restaurants and bars drink or purchase beer, some of the challenges he's run into.
Yeah, I commented on this post. I happen to love this concept, but I'm certainly not a profound expert on craft beer, but I consider myself at least an educated craft beer consumer, and I'm someone that, you know, I'm one of those drinkers that loves variety. I don't have that, you know, these two or three brand names that I just always have the fridge stocked with. Every time I go, I'm looking for something different. I get very weary of, I mean, I don't even like buying six packs anymore because I get tired of drinking them. I'm generally drinking bombers or picking a bunch of singles off the shelves.
Six packs.
What's that? I mean, yes, you're the only six pack I enjoy. And so I like the idea that you set this out to the aleheads, and there were a couple people that are very skeptical of this, and I think for very legit reasons. And you'll even see one of the first comments on his site is from a bar manager who basically says, you know, I like this concept because I like craft beer, but I don't know about my, you know, my consumers, because they're expecting consistency and reliability. And if every 3 months you're going to basically change up this mystery tap handle, you know, how are we going to keep that consistency? You know, my argument is that was probably true, you know, even as little as 4 or 5 years ago. But I think people have become so sophisticated about craft beer now that they do their research, they know what they like, and they become attached to breweries, not necessarily a specific beer. And beyond that, one of the reasons I love this, you and I talk about this all this time, the idea of, you know, of beer sitting out for too long, of it not being fresh. Now, granted, right now they're just starting it as, you know, I'm sure just, draft only, but eventually hopefully they'll move to bottles. And I love the idea of knowing that I can walk into my, you know, the beer store and know that, that this particular beer. So just to go over again, just in case it was confusing to anyone, he basically has four taste profiles. At any time of year, and within those, he's going to rotate out a different beer every season, every 3 months. So if you walk in and you see, and I'm going to look at his beers, he's got his little, so his hop forward line. In the spring, he's got a beer called Queen Anne's Revenge, which he's calling a Carolinian dark ale. He says it's an English style black IPA. I'm already interested. It already sounds great. But you know, if I'm, you know, in the winter, I happen to see a Queen Anne's Revenge sitting on the shelf, I know this is an old beer. So one of the reasons I like it is once I get used to his line and get used to the name of his beers, I will know that every 3 months his beer is getting rotated out. And if we're into a month into the next season and that beer is still on the shelf, I'll know it's not fresh. Yeah. And that's not something I want to buy. So I become more attached to him and his brewery. Again, let's put the caveat, assuming he's making good beer, and something I actually enjoy drinking, I become more attached to his brewery because he's one of the breweries where I can, without even looking at the dates, and some of those brewers use, you know, look at Sierra Nevada has one of the most confusing little codes you have to know. You know, they do like the first number is the year, and then the next four numbers or three numbers are like the day, not in the actual date, but on like just the number of days in the year. So it could be like 113, and that means it's the 113th day of the year. I mean, they're intentionally trying to sort of confuse you as to when this beer was brewed. And he doesn't even, you don't even have to look at the dates on Mysteries beers, unless you've already cycled into the next year, in which case you should notice the dust in the beer bottle, when these are, you know, rolled out. And as a big craft beer fan that loves variety, I think this is great. You know, if I like their hoppy beers, I know that I can, you know, drink a bunch of their summer hoppy beer, and then they can drink a bunch of their fall hoppy beer. And it's every year I'm anticipating, I'm excited about that beer coming out again.
Absolutely. And you look at somebody like Founders, who's probably the best in the business at most of this stuff, and they're always looking at it, even though I've seen lots of old Founders on the shelf, and they recently moved the Red's Rye,
yeah, good example,
which is a fantastic, wonderful beer. I mean, just I love it. But I could never find – I haven't bought one in probably 3.5 years, two and a half years. I don't even know how long. The last time I bought a bottle of Red's Rye, they've realized this and adjusted and moved that over to a seasonal thing where there isn't the demand for it. There's not that brand recognition. I think you can compare it to a company like Oscar Blues, who recently moved into Carolina, which is in the same market as Mystery, only probably 90 minutes away, where they're making beer and they're churning out a ton of dales. They do some seasonal sort of shifting. I think 1050 comes out in the fall, and whatnot, but, it's much more that aim to just churn out the seasonals, sponsor events, you know, pick up tap handles. And I can see how a small little regional place is going to try and differentiate itself by going to something like this, because I think that more and more beer drinkers are drawn more towards a loyalty towards the whole portfolio of beers. And
absolutely,
I'm certainly towards that. I mean, if I have one beer that I like from somebody, that doesn't mean I'm a fan of that brewery. I have to have several examples of different styles before I'm going to put my trust and be confident when I order, you know, something from them.
Yeah. You know, I'd say when I responded to this post on topfermented.com that, you know, I love innovation, and I think he had written in the post, he can't compete with the big bull, you know, Anheuser-Busch or Miller, but he also can't compete with Sam Adams or Oscar Blues or New Belgium. You know, those are breweries that have the resources to get cheaper ingredients, you know, to make the beer cheaper, to churn out more of them. So he has to, you know, he has said his advantage is that he can be nimble. You know, he's, as is always the case in a capitalist society, the smaller companies, their only real advantage is they can change things up a little quicker, because the big guys are these lumbering cruise ships that, you know, for Oscar Blues to change something, you know, seemingly small would take a ton of money and a ton of time, because they've grown so big and have their way of doing things. And he can very quickly every 3 months, make a, you know, really cool small barrel beer, because it's much easier to do things, as he says, on a 7-barrel scale than just do on a 100-barrel system or on a, you know, 100,000-barrel system that those other guys can't do. And there's a bunch of ways to be innovative. I think this is one. You look at what The Alchemist is doing. They're basically, they're mastering one beer. You know, when you go to their brewery, you can get a couple different other ones, but really they're looking at it and saying, we want to make the best double IPA in the country. And they're pretty
it's
much
a heady topper
they're
factory.
Pretty much success at, you know, being successful at that. But their way of being innovative is saying, we're going to put all of our eggs in this one basket, and we're going to make sure that this is the best damn beer out there, and that's going to support us. If you know that's a risky maneuver, because if you make a bad beer, it doesn't work. And in the case of The Alchemist, they happen to make a ridiculously good beer. So they're successful with that. That's one way of being innovative. And Eric is taking a different approach. He's basically saying, you know, I can't compete with these guys that have these flagship brands that everybody knows. So rather than having a true flagship approach, I'm going to basically convince you that I make, you know, these, that I'm really good at these flavor profiles. And I'm going to keep switching them out, and I'm not going to get your palate bored. You're not going to one day wake up and say, I don't like, you know, the mystery IPA anymore. 'Cause you're going to know in 3 months, you're going to get, another cool hop forward beer. The risk to this is you've got to make sure all 16 of those beers are rock solid. You know, that's because you don't want, if you're a small brewery and you're trying to get people, like you said, excited about your portfolio, you look at something like Founders, they make a few styles that I'm not crazy about, but they make them really well. Mystery needs to make sure that they do the same thing, that, you know, if I'm ready for my hop forward beer in the winter, that it is just as good as the one from the spring in the summer. And maybe that I like one more, that's always going to be the case, but at least make sure it's, you know, it's high quality stuff, and that they don't sort of take their foot off the pedal, one season or for one style that they're less interested in.
I think a danger for a company like Mystery is that Eric Myers definitely has this vision of what he thinks people want to drink. He has a very good idea of what he enjoys about a beer, and you just wonder if the two will necessarily mesh up. That just because it looks like he's tweaking different styles, talking about English milds. I mean, English milds aren't something that American craft brewers are selling. I mean, I think Goose Island maybe has an English mild, but it's not a style that you see selling crazy amounts. I mean, that's the kind of beer that he likes to drink, and he's putting his whole stake in that. And you have to give credit for it. I mean, there's that story with Founders, they came out with their the Bolt Cutter barley wine recently, which celebrated, I think, 10 years after the bank had actually put a big, long chain bolt across their door. And so they went out and bought some bolt cutters and cut it off and went in and started brewing the beer that they want to drink. And that's a wonderful story. And, I mean, it's part of the reason that I just love Founders. But there's a little bit of that in this story as well. I mean, he has an idea of this is the way that beer should be,
right?
But it's not the way that beer is now. And can, through a force of personality and great beer, can you get enough people to agree with you to make your business work, or are you just gonna, you know, sort of go down with your ship with your ego?
Well, it's the point I made before. If he's making incredible beer, he's going to be successful, because it's, you know, he's got this big variety of beers, and he's obviously very committed to this. He doesn't seem like a brewer that's trying to make millions upon millions of dollars. He just wants, he's something he's passionate about and wants to get out there. The Commander, when we were discussing this, pointed out, which it may very well be the case, that he's going to start this program, the 16 flagship program, and, you know, 2 years from now realize three of them are selling like crazy and the other 13 nobody really cares about, and all of a sudden he's got three flagships and that's what he's committed to brewing. It sounds like he is not, that he's very committed to this approach, but you do wonder when it gets to a certain point of, do I sink or swim, that, you know, maybe he starts ramping up a couple of these as year-round beers. Right now, I'm guessing if you asked, he would say absolutely not. But, you know, when the realities of bills coming in, you know, and some are paying them more than others, you know, will that be something he consider? But I think, again, you know, as little as 3 or 4 years ago, this wouldn't have worked. He probably would have failed. I think, you know, beer drinkers, and they're in North Carolina, which is a state that certainly has a wealth of craft beer and is craft beer sophisticated. this has the potential to be successful, but with that one caveat, you know, this can't be mediocre beer, and they all have to be winners. I mean, all 16 of these beers have to be winners, and that is a big challenge for any brewery, to make 16 phenomenal beers. There are very few breweries out there that pull that off, that make, you know, every single one down the line. So I certainly wish him the best of luck. As you said, he's a very knowledgeable guy, a great writer. If anybody can do this, can pull this off, he certainly can. And regardless if it's successful or not, I really do – I admire the innovation, and I admire any small brewer that looks at the industry the way it is now and sees how crowded and competitive it is and says, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to try it, and, you know, maybe people will come with me and maybe they won't, but I want to be an innovator, and if I'm successful, I can certainly lead the pack.
He just won $50,000 on a game show, so that'll give him a little bit of breathing room, I guess, to make sure that to test out his hypothesis about what beer should be.
All right, well, a couple smaller stories. So there's a microbrewery ordinance that has just passed in Kittery, Maine. Kittery, for those that didn't grow up in the New England area or the seacoast, small town about as south of Maine as you can get. It's right across the bridge from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And it's, you know, when I grew up, I sort of knew it as the outlet area. And it's mostly people that grew up in Massachusetts or New Hampshire. You would cross the bridge into Kittery and go to, it's one of the larger outlet malls in the U.S. But it's a great town, lots of good seafood restaurants, you know, sort of great Maine attitude. It's the first town in Maine you go to, and they just, you know, they sell cheap stuff to all the jackasses like myself coming up from Massachusetts to go get some lobster rolls and buy cheap pants. But they passed this ordinance. They've got a local guy, if you follow craft beer, you may have heard of, named Todd Mott, who was the brewmaster at the Portsmouth Brewery in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We had a wedding there a couple months ago, and we spent the night before the wedding at the Portsmouth Brewery. And they make some cool beer. But the beer that they were most famous for, that if you know anything about craft beer, you probably heard the name 1,000 times, is Cake the Great. One of the great American Imperial Stouts that was sort of famously voted a few years back as the best beer in America. Certainly been surpassed since then. This is based on beer rankings online, which are always kind of ridiculous to begin with. But I've had it with Smiley Brown, who was kind enough to share a bottle with me, and it is a wonderful, wonderful beer. But he left. Todd Mott left. I don't think anything negative. I think he just wanted to go branch out on his own. And part of the deal with him leaving was he basically got to take Cake the Great with him. He got to take the recipe with him. Is that the case? Am I saying that?
Yeah, that's correct.
And so Kittery, I love this. The local community basically said, hey, we've got this somewhat celebrity brewer coming back. Let's make sure we pass an ordinance that essentially lets him, you know, the language in it would let him open a microbrewery in town. I guess there was some zoning ordinance before that wouldn't have allowed that, and they basically changed the law essentially just to let this local boy come back and open a brewery so that he can brew something on par with Cake the Great, or I guess even Cake the Great itself. It'll be good to have the beer back if that's what he's if that's the intention. But I just think this is neat. You know, this small, you know, neat little town in Maine, basically saying we want you here, we want you to open a brewery here, so we're going to change the laws just to let you come in and brew great beer.
And he's also known for creating the original recipe for the Harpoon IPA, which obviously was one of the first commercially viable IPAs across New England. You know, fantastic brewer. And the ordinance opens up allowing for people to put in bakeries and coffee houses and, most importantly, brew pubs.
And wineries.
And,
as well.
Wineries, yep. And, I mean, I think it's fantastic. I'm just opening up the rules and getting rid of the bureaucratic nonsense. We follow tons of the progress of tons of breweries trying to get through all the bureaucratic red tape and the TTB licensing and the all the different ordinances that you have to pass. And it's a bear trying to open up a new brewery. So anytime we see the chance for basically one of the best and most well-known beers in America to be brewed again, it's an exciting thing.
Yeah, it's refreshing to read these stories, these small towns that sort of recognize the advantages beer brings. And I'll say, as someone that's been to Kittery a bunch, and, you know, again, just there a few weeks ago, It's a neat town. You know, as a mass whole, again, I saw it sort of as basically an outlet mall that had a town around it. But it doesn't have much of a nightlife. I mean, it's got some cool seafood restaurants and all those malls, but this will add to that. You know, having local brewery in town or winery, these bakeries, will add a lot more to the local flavor and local flair of town. I think, you know, just add a lot of business development. And, I love the quote at the end from one of the councilors, the city councilors in Kittery. You know, he's saying that he loved the debate, found it very interesting, but he's a little angry that most of the comments were on, you know, beer and wine, but he didn't get any free samples. That was the one thing he was pissed about, was that Todd Mott.
Well, that's on Todd Mott. I mean,
yeah. I mean, come on, Todd. If you want to get
to the there, I'd be like, this is a 10-year vertical of Kate the Great.
Right. Vote me in.
After we get done with this, then we should vote on this particular ordinance.
So exciting, and another reason to head up there and to visit Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Kittery, Maine, two great little towns in a great part of the great corner of the country. We like to always finish with kind of a sort of ridiculous story, and this is certainly a ridiculous one. This is a Kickstarter campaign, is that correct?
Yeah.
So this glassmaker, an artist, has basically looked.
We're doing air quotes.
Yeah, hard to describe this, and you probably want to go online and actually take a look at this thing, because I'm sure I'm not going to describe it and do it justice. But basically, this artist has looked at what's happening in bars these days, what's happening everywhere these days, and that people just aren't communicating anymore. They're all just sitting on their smartphones, and you see couples together where they're basically ignoring each other completely to just, you know, text and email on their smartphones. So he's developed a beer glass that will not stand up on its own unless it's about. So it's hard to describe, but basically picture, you know, a typical, like a Weizenglass, you know, sort of a kind of flared hourglass figure glass with a very thick base, you know, maybe a 3/4 inch thick base. And let's say you're looking at it from the bottom. So you're looking at it as a circle. Now picture half of it, like a half moon, basically cut off, you know, etched up a half inch into the glass and then removed. So if you try to
cantilevered way the fuck out.
Yeah. So basically, if you put it down, only half the base is actually touching the table, and as soon as you let go, the beer is just going to completely tip over on that side. So the only way you can put it down is to basically put it down on a reasonably thick block of something, which happens to be, you know, basically the exact dimensions of most commercial cell phones. It looks like it's mostly designed for an iPhone in a case, which is kind of, you know, the most ubiquitous phone. And, you know, especially with like an OtterBox around it, it's basically the perfect height for this thing. And it's obviously a marketing gimmick, but it's, you know, it's a neat idea. And as someone, you know, I work at an organization where I see a lot of parents and kids come to the place I work, and there are so many parents that just sit there on their cell phones the whole time and ignore their kids. And I hate it. And it is, you know, cell phones, smartphones are wonderful inventions. In a way, they do keep us connected. They allow us to talk to friends, you know, across the country. Slush and I talk all the time because we got smartphones and we don't live anywhere near each other. We barely see each other, but I feel like I'm connected because we're always in our phones together. It's great, you know, when you travel these days, you cannot possibly imagine how you were able to travel without smartphones in the past. But they do lead to these situations where you're basically just communicating with this little bright, you know, rectangle of light in front of you and not to each other. And bars are one of those places where you just need to put them away. You know, when you're there with people, it's all about, you know, having a nice drink and chatting with each other. And I think these artists were very frustrated to go to a bar and see half the population in the bar just with their face buried in a cell phone. So it's cheeky. I mean, it's just kind of the thing to say, hey, you know, remember why you're here. And obviously it's, you know, in a way it's kind of dumb because I don't want a beer that is going to spill if I accidentally put it down on something else. I like my beer to stay upright, and I'm someone that's very careful not to talk on their cell phone or smartphone when they're in a bar, because I'm very focused on – oh, I don't really talk to people anyways. I'm just focused on the beer. But I think it's sort of a cute idea, and, you know, I don't know. Is this something you think you would enjoy using in a bar, or do you think at least the logic behind it is sound? No?
What's that? that was on my phone, sorry.
Let me know what you're done.
Fucking Tony Soprano's dead.
I heard.
That is bullshit.
Damn it, Elfini. Oh, you just sent me a text? Hang on. I'm checking our Twitter account. So there you have it. Anyways, /6,
but
you could use one of these glasses.
No, I don't think you should have a beer glass that has a huge gouge cut out of it.
Fair enough.
That's not a good idea.
Well, the premise to me is important. A thing worth discussing, even if it's kind of a... a little too on your nose way of handling it. So personally, I'd rather when you walk into a bar, they just send off a giant electromagnetic pulse that destroys all electronic equipment. You just have to sit.
And diacetyl.
Yeah. Makes everything taste like butterscotch. All right, well, that's all the news that's fit to print for today. A lot of stories we discussed, all of them outrageously important, obviously.
We burned through this.
We did. So we hope you enjoy the podcast, as always. Please follow us on the mothership, aleheads.com. You can listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, or you can download this podcast directly from aleheads.com. For Slouch Six Pack, I am Brother Barley McHops. Good night and good drunk.